Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Managing the Treatment Side Effects, Aches and Pains of Myeloproliferative Neoplasms. And this is part two of Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasms. And today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline, and I really want to thank them for their support on this program today. Now, I just want to remind all of you that we have about 105 participants on this program today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of participants from Canada, Pakistan, Philippines, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Akriti Jain, and Dr. Jain is Associate Staff, Leukemia and Myeloid Disorders Division, Tausig Cancer Center Institute, Cleveland Clinic. And Dr. Jain will be addressing review of the treatments for polycythemia vera, PV, essential thrombocythemia, ET, and myelofibrosis, MF. And she'll also address common treatment side effects. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Jain.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for that kind introduction, and thank you so much for this pleasure of talking in this podium. In the next few minutes, I'm going to talk about polycythemia vera, or PV, essential thrombocythemia, or ET, and myelofibrosis, which are all types of myeloproliferative neoplasms. I think it's important to understand when I explain these to patients, I tell them that myelo is borrowed from Greek language, which means bone marrow, and proliferative means to increase in number or to multiply rapidly. And it's important to understand what's going on in the background in the bone marrow because that is what helps us guide treatment and management of these MPNs, or myeloproliferative neoplasms. Each of these conditions present unique treatment challenges and treatment approaches focus on controlling symptoms, preventing complications, and reducing the risk of disease progression. First, talking about PV, or polycythemia vera, this is where the bone marrow makes extra red blood cells, and when we look at the lab or laboratory exam, hemoglobin or hematocrit is increased. The main mainstay of treatment, or the first and foremost treatment of PV, is phlebotomy, which includes regular blood removal or blood letting to reduce red blood cell mass and hence decrease blood viscosity. This can help alleviate symptoms like headache, dizziness, and itching, which are common MPN or myeloproliferative symptoms. Another important mainstay is aspirin. Low-dose aspirin is used to reduce the risk of blood clots, which is also common in patients with polycythemia vera. When bloodletting and aspirin are not enough or not helping control that hemoglobin or hematocrit level, and we're trying to keep that hematocrit less than 45 to reduce the risk of blood clots, strokes, and heart attacks, we use another type of drug called hydroxyurea, or Hydrea. This is an old type of chemotherapy drug. It's commonly prescribed for patients who are at high risk of complications, and where the hematocrit doesn't stay at less than 45 despite regular phlebotomies. How hydroxyurea works is that it reduces the production of blood cells in the bone marrow, hence decreasing that hemoglobin or hematocrit level. And then our next line of therapy in patients with BV include JAK inhibitors, which includes drugs like Jakafi or ruxolitinib, which helps in patients that are resistant to or intolerant to hydroxyurea. These JAK inhibitors work by inhibiting the JAK-STAT pathway, which is responsible for excessive red blood cell production. And then another last form of therapy within the polycythemia vera management category that I would like to talk about is interferon. So some patients can benefit from interferon therapy, which are injections. Interferons have recently been shown to reduce the allele burden of JAK2 and maybe help modify disease. So summarizing treatment for polycythemia vera, mainstay is phlebotomies. We use aspirin. And then other options that we have are hydroxyurea or Hydrea, JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib, and interferon. Next, moving on to essential thrombocythemia or essential thrombocytosis. This is a type of MPN where the bone marrow makes extra platelets. Sometimes the bone marrow can also make extra hemoglobin, but mainly it's extra platelets. Treatment of ET is risk stratified. So we divide our patients into very low risk, or very high risk based on certain criteria. And this risk is the risk of developing blood clots. So the main criteria that we use for risk stratification are age. So if someone's over 60 or less than 60, if they've had prior blood clots, like deep venous thrombosis or pulmonary embolism, and whether they have the JAK2 mutation or not. So these three criteria help us divide our patients into various risk categories. For low-risk disease, the usual recommendation is low-dose aspirin, and that decreases their risk for blood clots. For patients that have high-risk disease, it is recommended that we use cytoreductive therapy, which basically means reducing the platelet count. And options for cytoreductive therapy are similar to what we use in polycythemia vera, like Hydrea and interferon. And another option that we have is anagrelide. And then if Hydrea or interferon or anagrelide are not getting the platelet level to where we want to, or our patients are intolerant to these drugs, we can also use JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib. And I'm going through these therapies first, and we'll address side effects together, because a lot of these therapies that we use for BV or myelofibrosis are similar, and we can talk about side effects in the end. So again, summarizing for ET, therapy is very similar to PV. The idea is to bring the platelet count down. We have aspirin, Hydrea, interferon, anagrelide, and then JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib. And then lastly, for myelofibrosis, our treatment algorithm depends on what the presenting symptoms are. There is a symptom assessment form or symptom assessment score that we use for our patients, wherein we ask patients to give a score between 0 to 10 for each symptom, including fatigue, abdominal pain, early satiety, inactivity, problems concentrating, night sweats, itching, bone pain, fever, and weight loss. This is called the MPN symptom assessment score or symptom assessment form. And based on whether patients present with a high symptom assessment score or MPN SAS, we use JAK inhibitors to help control these symptoms. Whereas if patients do not present with a high symptom assessment score or do not present with splenomegaly or an enlarged spleen, we focus on their presenting symptom. So if someone's presenting symptom is anemia, we can consider anemia-directed therapy depending on certain lab parameters like EPO level. We can use erythropoiesis-stimulating agents. We can use other drugs like luspatercept, immunomodulatory drugs, or danazol. So this is more anemia-directed therapy where someone's not presenting with an enlarged spleen or a high symptom burden. If patients have a high symptom burden, then we have multiple JAK inhibitors that are approved for myelofibrosis. The four that we have are ruxolitinib, momelotinib, pacritinib, and fedratinib. Ruxolitinib is the usual frontline recommended treatment unless a patient also has anemia along with a high symptom burden. We can use momelotinib, or if someone has platelets that are low along with a high symptom burden, we can use pacritinib. Fedratinib is usually reserved for second-line treatment. Another treatment option that I haven't discussed yet for PV or ET, which becomes all the more important in myelofibrosis, whether it's primary myelofibrosis, where myelofibrosis occurred to begin with, versus secondary, where myelofibrosis or scarring inside the bone marrow occurred as disease progression after PV or ET. One of the mainstays of curing this disease is a stem cell transplant. So that's also an option to refer our patients to our transplant colleagues if someone has intermediate to high risk disease based on some of our scoring symptoms. So that was a whirlwind of treatment options. Now looking at side effects of each of these options, some of the first things we talked about was phlebotomy. Phlebotomy can, of course, cause fatigue, can cause lightheadedness, can cause low blood pressure. Patients can have a feeling of like they're going to pass out after having bloodletting done. And it leads to a functional iron deficiency state where we're decreasing the amount of iron available for making red blood cells, which can also cause fatigue. And then aspirin, which we use in a lot of our MPNs, it is an antiplatelet agent, so it can cause increased risk for bleeding, can cause GI or gastrointestinal irritation, and sometimes can also cause ulcers. And then specifically looking at our cytoreductive agents, Hydrea and anagrelide, they can both cause bone marrow suppression. So what that means is what we're trying to achieve is low hemoglobin or low platelets, but it can also cause low white cells, which can increase the risk of infection, can cause GI symptoms like nausea, and then sometimes even secondary cancers like skin cancers. Interferon specifically has a very special side effect profile. It can cause flu-like symptoms, including fever, chills, and muscle aches. Sometimes can cause liver dysfunction and psychological symptoms like depression or anxiety. And lastly, for JAK inhibitors, main side effects that can occur with them are anemia or low red cells, thrombocytopenia, bruising, fatigue, and then infections. We also have to keep a close eye on liver numbers, and sometimes some of the JAK inhibitors can cause diarrhea and nausea. So those were the common side effects and treatment options. Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. J. That was just an extraordinary, wonderful, stellar presentation, actually. And you're the first speaker, so you've really set the tone for today's program. And so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Gabriella Hobbs, and Dr. Hobbs is Clinical Director, Leukemia Service, Massachusetts General Hospital, Associate Professor, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Hobbs will be addressing reducing complications of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs, or what you need to know and do, key concerns to discuss with your doctor and healthcare team, including treatment side effects and symptoms requiring immediate attention between appointments. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hobbs.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that introduction and for having me today. And I'll try to be as eloquent as Dr. Jane as that was a great presentation. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here today. So first I'll start with reducing complications of myeloproliferative neoplasms. So this is actually a very common question that I get asked, and I was just talking with the other presenters today before everybody joined, and this is really a common question that we all get. What can I do to stay healthy? What can I do to prevent complications from my MPN? And I would say that I'll give a kind of a general question, but it really does apply to MPNs regardless of which type of MPN you have and where you are on the disease spectrum. And so one thing to keep in mind is that MPNs, or myeloproliferative neoplasms, are chronic conditions that people are going to live with for many years and hopefully many decades. And so staying healthy outside of just the therapy directly related to the MPN is very important. And this is important for a variety of reasons. So patients with MPNs generally, you know, are very concerned about disease progression, their disease getting worse, et cetera. And that, unfortunately, it's out of our control. We can't prevent the disease from changing over time. But one of the things that we can do is reduce some of the complications associated with MPNs. And the most common complications associated with MPNs are actually related to what are called thrombotic complications or blood clot-related complications. And these can occur in both arteries and veins. And we are actually able to reduce the chances of having one of these complications by taking care of both our MPN directly by the medications that we may take for the MPN, and this includes medications that Dr. Jane mentioned, for example, like taking an aspirin, and also by taking medications that will reduce the level of your blood counts to ensure that they're in good range, and we know that those two things together will reduce the complications of the MPN, specifically reduce the risk of having a blood clot. But in addition to the medicines that you may take for the MPN, making sure that the rest of your cardiovascular system is well controlled is also really important. So what do we need to do for that? Having an active and healthy lifestyle is really important. And so being proactive about that, asking your doctor, not just the doctor and healthcare team that helps to take care of your MPN, but also your primary care doctor, and seeking advice from perhaps other providers, including nutritionists, cardiologists, et cetera, is also can also be very helpful. And so a first step is basically what I mentioned, and that is having a healthy and active lifestyle and learning what that means. You know, for some patients, they may already be doing all of those things. They may feel like they have a good understanding of what a healthy diet means. They may feel like they also have they already have a healthy amount of exercise and movement in their life, but some patients may not have a lot of experience with that or may want some more information. So making sure you get more information about how to eat healthy, how to have a balanced diet, and how to start participating in exercise or start participating in activities that require movement is really important. And so people are definitely in very different aspects of this continuum. And so getting more information about that is really important. And why is that so important? So if you have a healthy diet and also exercise routine, you can also help to prevent the development of cardiovascular comorbidities such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and obesity. And all of these cardiovascular comorbidities can contribute to the development of blood clots. And so having a healthy and active lifestyle can help to manage those conditions if you already have them, or can help to prevent those complications from occurring if you do not have those. So I would say that is definitely really important. And in addition to that, we know that patients that exercise regularly usually can also experience improvement in the symptoms of their MPN, can experience an improved sense of well-being, increased energy and decreased rates of depression. So there's many good reasons for having a healthy and active lifestyle. And along those lines, I think many times patients are so connected to their hematology team that they sometimes forget that they need to have other providers as well. And so ensuring that you have a good relationship with a primary care doctor, and like I mentioned before, if other doctors are necessary in your care, like cardiologists, et cetera, don't forget about those relationships, because they really are good partners for the management of your MPN as well. Now, in terms of generally speaking, medications taken for the MPN, I think that it's important to understand what medications you are taking for the MPN specifically and why you are taking those medications, so that you can ensure that you're taking those medications at the correct time, at the correct dose, and that you don't have any issues getting those medications. Oftentimes, many of the medications that we take for MPNs, especially hydroxyurea, will require a lot of adjustments, so it's not uncommon for the patient and sometimes the care team as well to not have a correct understanding of the exact dose that the patient is supposed to be on. And so that's important in order to reduce complications related to VMPN. And now switching gears a little bit, discussing key concerns that I think need to be discussed with your doctor and healthcare team. We talked about this a little bit in the previous sentences that I mentioned, but I would say when you leave the patient, the doctor's office or your healthcare team's office, making sure that you have a checklist of the following, I think, is really important. Are you leaving that visit with a clear understanding of the medications that you're supposed to be on, the dose that you're supposed to be on, how frequently you're supposed to take that medication? Do you know how that medication is going to be delivered to your house? Are you going to receive a call from a specialty pharmacy, or are you going to pick that up at a regular pharmacy? Do you have an understanding of who to talk to about copays? And do you understand how to take that medication? All of those things are important. Do you have a clear sense of the plan between those visits? So maybe the plan was to try medication, a new medication for a few weeks and then have a follow-up visit. Do you know how to make that follow-up visit? And then if you're starting a new medication or if you are switching to another medication, do you know what to expect from that medication? Do you know what side effects to expect, even if it's a medicine that you've already been on, but it's a dose change, should you expect to feel any differently? And especially if it's a new medication, what side effects should you expect, and do you know how to manage them? Did your doctor talk to you about supportive medications that you could take to make it easier to tolerate that medication? Do you know if the side effects are going to get better or worse over time? And along those lines, do you know who you need to call, or how do you communicate with your care team in between visits? Now with the advent of electronic medical records and communication in the electronic medical record, I would say many patients do have a good understanding of how to send messages electronically to their care team, but it's also important to know if you don't have access to one of these patient portals, do you have a phone number of who you can call? In between visits, one of the common questions that patients will ask me is, what do I need to look out for, doc? When do I need to call you? And I would say the most important thing to recognize is that you're not being asked to be your own doctor. So if something is concerning, please, please, please go seek care immediately. Certainly you can call the doctor or the clinic that treats you, but don't wait if something is worrisome. So things that are worrisome, of course, include things like shortness of breath, chest pain, changes in the way you're able to move a part of your body. But generally speaking, I would say to patients, like I already mentioned again, but it's worth repeating, don't feel like you need to be your own doctor. If something is concerning you, then definitely seek care immediately. Now, outside of things that are emergencies, I would say that one of the difficulties of living with a chronic condition is that it's sometimes hard to know if what you're feeling is related to the MPN or if it's related to something else. And oftentimes there's not a quick way to figure out what is what. And so I would say if you're having a symptom and it just kind of comes and goes and then doesn't cause you much trouble, I would say it's probably okay to ignore that. If you have a symptom that comes and stays or comes and gets worse, probably a good idea to reach out to your team. And if they think that it's not related to your MPN, then they can direct you and let you know to talk to your primary care doctor or to other members of your healthcare team. But things in general to look out for are things that are side effects of the medications that you're taking. So that's why it's important to talk to your doctor about what to expect of those medications. And then anything that's new or that's concerning to you is worth reaching out to your doctor. Again, don't feel like you need to be your own doctor and diagnose yourself. And with that, I'll conclude my section. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hobbs. That was just an excellent, stellar presentation, really. And a lot of important information for our participants, and I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A as well, so it's very well done. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Christina Gowan, and Dr. Gowan is Associate Clinical Professor, Director of Education, Chang Family Center for Integrative Oncology, Departments of Supportive Care Medicine, and Hematology HCT. City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Gowan will be addressing keeping a journal of specific side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain to report to your doctor. Know the warning signs of a potential medical emergency and what to do, how being more assertive may improve your care and quality of life. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Garland.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Messner, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you, Dr. Jane and Dr. Hobbs. You all were, as spoken before, so eloquent and gave so much wonderful information. And so I hope to highlight some of the wonderful points you made. I want to welcome everybody to the call today. This is truly an international call. And so it's so wonderful we can come together all over the globe to learn together. So I really want to congratulate you for seeking this out and honor your time for advocating for your health and wellness. So we're going to jump into a topic that I really, really love, and it's keeping a journal. And I will say that patients who routinely keep a journal really have a good handle on where their symptom burden is. And Dr. Jane had mentioned this in her presentation, that really symptom burden helps us as your physician to understand how to better treat your disease. It helps us to know when we need to start medications. It helps us to know when we actually need to change medications. So your symptoms are incredibly important. However, it's very hard, as you, I'm sure, can to attest to remember your symptoms over a three-month period, which is a routine follow-up. And so a journal is very helpful, where you can really maintain all of the different kind of aspects of what's going on in relation to your symptoms as far as when they started. What are their severity? How long do they last? And this can be in regards to any number of your symptoms, right? Fatigue, night sweat, bruising, weight loss, mental clarity even. So I would encourage you, number one, to go out and get a journal, because first, before you can start journaling, you need to get one. You can certainly use the old school pen and paper, which is really wonderful. Although if that is really not what you're resonating with, you can use your phone, your computer, anything where you have a daily kind of connection to start putting in some of your symptoms can be really helpful. Other things that you may want to include in your journal would be some of your side effects. Any reactions to your medications, such as nausea, dizziness, headaches, you may want to start to really kind of make note of that in your journal. Additionally, really paying attention to your pain level. And not only is it there, yes or no, but what is it on a scale of 1 to 10? And note where it's occurring and what's triggering it and what's relieving it. All these different aspects of pain can be important to include into your journal. We really want to track changes. So yes, is it present, yes or no, but is it changing over time? So your weight, for example, so maybe jotting down your daily weight would be a nice thing, as well as your appetites, if you're having a low or even increased appetite, sleep patterns, mental health, all of that can be really tracked longitudinally, so we can have a really great conversation when you bring that back to clinic. I would say one of the tricks is consistency. So trying to do it on a daily basis, trying to do it roughly at the same time each day, so you can really get into a habit and a pattern. You may have heard of this concept called habit stacking. And so something that you do every day already, perhaps put journaling part of that, such as getting your morning coffee right after brushing your teeth. These can be ways to really engage into that consistency. So we're going to move a little away now from journaling, which is kind of this nurturing, restorative exercise, and then move into kind of the polar opposite, which is what are the warning signs of a medical emergency? And this was really addressed
in part by Dr. Hobbs, but I'd like to really underline and emphasize that, oh my goodness, we don't want you to be your doctor. I love that statement. Don't feel like you need to be your own doctor. That if something is unusual, we want to know about it. But beyond that, you should know that there are particular things that should drive you straight to the emergency room, and you can reach out to us on the way. But uncontrolled bleeding, certainly, we have talked a little bit about how in myeloproliferative neoplasms, you're at risk for blood clots, but on the flip side, you can actually also be at risk for bleeding events. So any excessive bleeding from small cuts or unusual bruising is really a medical emergency. Severe headaches or vision changes may indicate a blood clot or a stroke. Certainly, chest pain or shortness of breath and fever, signs of infection, swelling of the legs also potentially can indicate that there's a blood clot there. So what do you do if these things occur? I would say number one, act quickly. Don't wait, call 911 or go to the nearest emergency room. You really want to describe your symptoms, but also right away mention your MPN diagnosis. And then always be prepared in regards to carrying your medical information, have your list of medications, your diagnosis, and your emergency contacts all ready for any kind of medical emergency. And that really leads us into how to be assertive to improve your care. And assertive and proactive kind of go hand in hand, and it's truly essential to manage your health because it's advocating for your needs and really ensuring that you're heard. So how can you be more assertive or proactive? Number one, preparing for your appointments, bringing that journal that we had talked about, asking specific questions that maybe had come up over the last few weeks prior to your appointment, and certainly take some notes during the visit. You can bring a friend or a family member and have another set of ears, so that can be very helpful as well. Being assertive is about truly communicating your concerns. So if something doesn't feel right, please speak up. We want to hear about those things. And ask for clarifications. Don't hesitate to ask for further explanation, certainly about medical terms or treatment options. We want to hear those things as well. And then feel free, and we encourage second opinions. It's always okay to get another opinion from an expert. And some of the benefits of this kind of assertiveness is to truly ensure that the symptoms are addressed promptly. It really helps us as your doctor and your care team to tailor your treatment to your needs, and it gives you a sense of control and confidence in your care. So in conclusion, keeping a detailed journal, recognizing these important emergency symptoms, and being assertive, you really kind of empower yourself to take charge of your health and improve your quality of life. So I'll close there, but thank you so much for everyone's time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gowan. That was just a wonderful presentation and stellar, and a lot of excellent information for people to be aware of, and I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services, and then we will move on soon to the Q&A, but I just wanted to say a few words. Cancer care is a national organization, and it provides free programs and services to people throughout the United States, and those programs, people can often access the programs in the United States by calling our hope line, 800-813-4673, or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. So what are our free services and programs? So we do offer financial assistance and practical assistance. We do have a co-payment assistance program. We also do have online support groups on every different type of cancer or for all different relationships to the person with cancer. So we have MPN groups, but we also have groups for caregivers, for young adults, for older adults, for LGBTQ. We have really support groups for everybody who might need them. And you can go to our website and you'll see a whole listing of all of our online support groups. We also publish a number of publications, and those are available. You can download them from our website and fact sheets as well. And we also have them on MPNs as well. And we also have, we do these workshops, about 70 a year. So we have more coming up. So just to give you a thumbnail sketch of all that we do. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So question for Dr. Jane. How do side effects range or differ based on different MPN diseases?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. Of course, side effects are different based on different treatments that we're using. But for each specific treatment, the side effects that we observe are similar, as in my opinion, across the spectrum. For example, if we are using ruxolitinib for PV or sometimes for ET or for MF, it can cause low hemoglobin or anemia in the beginning for all patients, and then sometimes that hemoglobin kind of plateaus out or improves at the three-month mark. If you're using Hydrea for any of the three diseases, it causes the same bone marrow suppression or cytopenias or low blood counts in all three diseases. In the myelofibrosis part, what you're trying to achieve is different when you're using ruxolitinib compared to other MPNs like ET or PV. So our endpoints or what we're trying to achieve is different, but the side effects that the treatments can cause are very similar, in my opinion.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And the next question is for Dr. Hobbs. I recently started taking hydroxyurea and am experiencing a few GI symptoms like nausea and diarrhea. What over-the-counter medications are recommended to alleviate these symptoms?
That's a good question, and I would say, you know, generally speaking with hydroxyurea, if people are going to have some of those GI side effects, they're more common at the beginning of treatment, and I usually like telling patients to take this medication kind of right before they go to sleep to kind of avoid some of those symptoms if they have them. Some helpful over-the-counter things can include things like antacids that you can buy over-the-counter, you know, starting with things like Tums to Zantac. All of those things are over-the-counter. But I would say if really the nausea is the predominant symptom, then I think it's not a bad idea to talk to your doctor or healthcare team to see if they can give you a nausea medicine. We generally start with a medicine such as Compazine. And the other thing that I was going to say is that if diarrhea is a significant component of the side effect, you can also buy some over-the-counter Imodium. Take that carefully so that you don't end up swinging to the other side. But so those are a few things you can buy over-the-counter. And then also, you know, talking about what Dr. Gowan was talking about, keeping track of your symptoms with a diary. You know, sometimes people realize that there are certain foods that make it more irritating to take that medication than others, and so keeping track of what foods may be contributing to those symptoms is important too.
Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Gowan. What do you recommend to treat constant itching?
Yeah, so constant itching is such a challenge, pruritus, and I will say that it's, you know, the best treatment is really the systemic treatment that you're on for either your PV or ET. Sometimes some moisturizing agents can be helpful, watching the temperature of your shower, making sure that it's lukewarm. Wearing loose and light clothing can be helpful. And then there are some kind of pharmacologic agents, some antihistamines that you can talk with your doctor to help you with that. But I will tell you, just to validate the experience, that the itching can be a really challenge, a big challenge. And so I would definitely not downplay that, and really talk with your team and your treatment provider about potential pharmacologics, because you may really need that.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And question for Dr. Jane. Do you have any tips on oral care for people with MPNs like ET? I have issues with my gums bleeding and would like to know if there's any way to prevent or alleviate it.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think one of the main things is maintain. I know we try to do our best, but to maintain good oral hygiene, and making sure we're using a soft toothbrush to brush our teeth. I think this might be another good question for Dr. Govin to add in on as well, from the integrative medicine side, if there's anything else. But those are the things that I can think of at the top of my head.
Thank you. And Dr. Govin, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think those are wonderful recommendations, Dr. Jane. And although there's no good evidence base for a particular supplement, there are the actual mouthwashes out there, and there's a tea tree mouthwash that can be helpful for some that are a little bit less irritating than some of the other kind of over-the-counter mouthwashes. So that could be something to be considered. Again, not a lot of evidence for that. So I think the mainstay is really good oral hygiene, gentle brushing with a soft brush.
Thank you so much. A question for Dr. Hobbs, what are some signs to look for with clotting? How do I know when to be concerned?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm going to repeat some of the things that I said before. I would say if there's a symptom that's really concerning or you're really just not feeling well, the most important thing is to just seek care, because what we say here, or some of the information that I'll provide you, is really not sufficient to substitute for, a full evaluation in person and a real diagnosis. And so some of the common presentations of blood clots include what we say asymmetric, one leg looks puffy and the other one doesn't. So asymmetric leg swelling. So one leg is really swollen, it could be red, it could be painful, it can be warm, and the other one isn't, and this could be something that can occur kind of out of the blue. Some of the risk factors for this may include things like, being immobile for a long time, having had a recent surgery, or, typical things are long trips, but generally this can occur also kind of out of the blue. Feeling chest pain and shortness of breath, or even abdominal pain that is kind of sudden and doesn't seem to be going away, that could also be a symptom of a blood clot. The most common that we think about is just that asymmetric leg swelling. But really, because a blood clot basically gets in the way of blood flow to any part of the body, the symptoms can involve any part of the body as well.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Gowan. Are we choosing the treatment based on the patient characteristics more or based on the disease progression?
Oh, what an excellent question. And so it really depends on where you are in the treatment course. So certainly when we are meeting a patient for the first time, we're looking at that patient and we're saying, what is the disease? What is the risk of the disease? And then what is the symptom burden? And we're taking all of that into account, as well as what Dr. Hobbs was speaking to, is what is the cardiovascular risk of the person in front of me? So it's truly a really personalized approach to the first kind of diagnosis. And then we make treatment decisions based on progression from there, right? We look for progression of symptoms. We look for progression of blood counts, either going too high or too low. And we also look for progression of allele burden. We talked a little bit about that as well. How many copies of the JAK V617F do you have? We look for progression even on bone marrow. What is the grade of scarring on bone marrow? So it's always a very personalized kind of evaluation between you and your doctor about all of those different things.
So thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Jane, how does allele burden impact the disease?
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about is allele burden, which basically means the variable allele frequency or the amount or percentage of mutation that we see, which is more well known for JAK2 than the other type of mutations like CALR and MPL. This is still work in progress. You know, we think that if we are decreasing the allele burden, we're decreasing the amount of progression or improving the disease or natural history of the disease. That's what we like to think. But whether this improves outcomes for our patients, there's more to come on this.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Hobbs, can MPNs be treated with medications like aspirin? I've read about using baby aspirin to thin the blood, but how feasible is that for treatment?
Good question. So aspirin is definitely the backbone of our treatment for MPNs. And so essentially every patient with polycythemia vera, unless they have a reason not to, needs to be on a baby aspirin. Most patients with essential thrombocythemia, although some don't need it, should also be on the baby aspirin. And then with myelofibrosis, it's more on a case-by-case basis. I would say that it's not as emphasized in the guidelines, but patients with myelofibrosis also are at increased risk of having blood clots. So if there's no contraindications and they don't have low platelets, and especially if they have other cardiovascular issues, then aspirin is something that's very important. You are correct that aspirin is a blood thinner. It keeps platelets from kind of lumping together, and it's been shown for patients with MPNs to help to improve their outcomes and prevent blood clots. So a baby aspirin, and that's all you need, is really, really quite important. Sometimes patients may benefit from a higher dose, but for the most part, people start with 81 milligrams a day.
Excellent. Thank you. And I just want to remind everyone that we have another program on MPN on February 7th, the role of nutrition, exercise, and meditation in coping with myeloproliferative neoplasms. So stay tuned, and we'll be, of course, sending you reminders about all of that as well. And I'm going to ask our speakers if you would just provide takeaways for our participants, and I'll start with Dr. Gowan, if you would provide the first takeaway.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, again, it's just been an honor to participate in today's call. And I think the key takeaway I'd like to leave is that it's truly an exciting time for myeloproliferative neoplasm patients, in that we are getting more and more therapeutics, and not only in number, but in different kinds of ways they work, and that they're now really focused on not only controlling the disease, but getting at the root cause, that there's some disease-modifying agents, which is really, really exciting that we're really kind of getting to the root of the MPN. And then I think lifestyle medicine is really exciting, that we're finding more and more that lifestyle impacts inflammation. Inflammation impacts myeloproliferative neoplasms, both their symptom burden, but also the outcomes. And so that's something that we can control. That's something that you all can control through your choices, through Mediterranean diet, through movement, through stress reduction, adequate sleep. And so it's an empowering time for MPN patients, because there's a lot going on in the science, and then there's a lot that you can do at home.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Gowan. Dr. Jane, a takeaway.
Yes, I think Dr. Gowan hit really good points in terms of inflammation and inflammation affecting myeloproliferative neoplasms. I think one thing we didn't bring up today is clinical trials. I think that's a big part of what we do and what we've gotten, and that's something we should discuss always with our physician or options in terms of trials that they have available where you're seeing them versus other places. But it's an exciting time. We have a lot of options for our patients, and when we have a lot of options, it requires a good, thorough discussion between the patient and the physician in terms of what's best for each patient. So we want to focus on individualized approach and so kind of guiding your physician through what is what they can help you and what is your goal and what do you want to achieve is what helps the physician decide what's, or, you know, make a decision together for what's best for each and every patient.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Hobbs?
Thank you so much, and I think I would just like to echo what both of my colleagues just said and said so well, and kind of to add to that, I would say this is a really exciting time in MPN, and there's a lot of information out there, and I think that seeking information from activities such as this one, and there's a variety of other webinars that are available online, as well as patient advocacy organizations that hold in-person events, can also be really, really helpful, because in a time where we have so much information out there, I often find that sometimes patients, you know, find it overwhelming to know where to seek information. And so I would say congratulations to all of you for trying to seek out information from a reliable source such as this one. And I encourage you to continue to try to do that so that you don't end up, you know, just getting information from social media groups and things like that that maybe sometimes are misleading and sometimes kind of stressful. And outside of that, remember that in addition to being in control of the information that you gather, you also have control over the way that you take care of yourself as well. And I think that we mentioned this multiple times throughout the talk, but that lifestyle medicine component to the traditional care of your MPN will help you all around to be more successful with living with this disease from both a mental as well as a psychological perspective.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been a phenomenal program, I must say. We have another program coming up, which will be really focusing on lifestyle. And so I hope I know many of you will be signing up for that. I do want to comment, though, that there were so many of you on the call that we couldn't take everyone's question. So I do want to comment for those who asked a question or for those who have a question yet in queue, please do take your question to your healthcare team. So you've learned a lot today, but we'd like you to take what you've learned and ask the question of your healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have their records, you know, their records in front of them. And they're able to really address your concerns and questions, and that's really important. Also, the other thing that I want to leave you with is that it seems that during the day, people often can reach their healthcare provider, but evenings, weekends, and holidays become a big problem for reaching someone or knowing who to call or what number to call. And so I would suggest that you check with your healthcare team in terms of what number you should call, who's available, evenings, weekends, and holidays. And although it's true we've just finished a whole period of holidays, we have more coming up. And so please do be sure to ask your healthcare team what is the number you should call on evenings, weekends, and holidays. Now, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I have to say our speakers have been phenomenal, and you as participants have been phenomenal by asking such really great questions. And keep asking your questions because they're really important so that you know the most about myeloproliferative neoplasms, your particular type of MPN, and also, you know, really keeping up with all of the latest information and even participating or thinking of participating in the clinical trials. It's so important. Remember, the clinical trials allow the treatment of MPNs to enhance over time. And so people who participate in clinical trials are really those who are who really move the treatment along in ways that didn't exist years before. So there's an excitement about clinical trials. It's really important. always considered as a possible treatment option. And I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.